The Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We have been running a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters for the last couple years, and the phone number has recently changed. You can now reach us at 438-858-6116. We would like to thank Fed Phone Line for providing us with this number for free. They wanted us to tell you that they help save money to inmates, family, and friends by reducing the cost of collect calls. For more information about their company, you can go to fedphoneline.com. So again, our new number is 438-858-6116. You can call us collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere de Prairie Prison at that number. As always, we're an all-volunteer collective and don't always manage to answer the phone. If you can leave a message, please do. If you are calling collect and we don't pick up, try again next time you can get to the phone. And again, our phone number is 438-858-6116, and you can call us collect from Riviere de Prairie Prison or Bordeaux Prison.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
The World Central Kitchen has suspended aid operations in Gaza after an Israeli airstrike killed six international workers from the charity and their Palestinian driver. The aid workers were struck after they left a warehouse in Deir al-Bala, where it had unloaded more than 100 tons of food aid that they had brought into Gaza by ship from Cyprus to help avert a looming famine. The aid workers were driving in a clearly marked convoy branded with the charity's logo. World Central Kitchen said the attack occurred even though the charity had coordinated in advance about the convoy with the Israeli military. The killed aid workers include three British nationals, an Australian, a Polish national, and an American-Canadian dual citizen. Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese condemned the attack.
We certainly have already contacted the Israeli government directly. We are contacting the Israeli ambassador to ask for accountability here. The truth is that this is beyond any reasonable circumstances. Someone going about providing aid and humanitarian assistance should lose their life. And there were four aid workers as well as Palestinian driver in this vehicle. This is a human tragedy that should never have occurred. That is completely unacceptable.
Earlier today, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appeared to acknowledge Israel carried out the attack, saying, quote, unfortunately, over the last day, there was a tragic incident of an unintended strike of our forces on innocent people in the Gaza Strip, unquote. The United Nations aid coordinator for the occupied Palestinian territory, Jamie McGoldrick, said, quote, this is not an isolated incident. As of March 20th, at least 196 humanitarians had been killed in the occupied Palestinian territory since October 2023. This is nearly three times the death toll recorded in any single conflict in a year, they said. We begin today's show in Rafah, Gaza, where we're joined by the Gaza-based journalist Akram El-Sattari. Akram, thanks so much for joining us again. What do you understand took place? Talk about Chef Jose Andres's charity workers who were killed and their driver, what they were doing.
They were helping people. They were trying to secure the food aid for the people in Gaza, whom they were in touch with, whom they were eating with, whom they were in solidarity with, whom they were thinking, they deserve to be treated as humans, and they deserve to be safe, and they deserve to be secured. However, they themselves, the ones who were there extending the helping hand, ended up being killed by an Israeli attack, the circumstances of which are not clear yet, neither to the government of Israel that apparently ordered the attack, no matter what the circumstances are, nor to the Palestinians who have been seeing at least foreigners there with them extending a helping hand and trying to secure a lifeline while their lives were taken by that Israeli attack.
And Akram, how does this happen when reportedly World Central Kitchen was coordinating its efforts and was informing the Israelis of where its aid workers were?
Well, this is the fact that shocked everyone. And as a matter of fact, many other international aid workers and some UNRWA workers also were affected by the ongoing bombardment. The UNRWA made a specific statement about the number of UNRWA staff who were killed, which is around 166 UNRWA staff who were killed while they are on job, while they're moving from their places to their duty stations, and when they're back from their duty stations to their homes, or even when they're still conducting their job in their duty station, extending a helping hand to the people. The coordinates are very well clear for the Israeli army. This is a protocol that has been followed ever since the war has started. Every single humanitarian aid worker that is extending a helping hand in Gaza, that is coordinating or helping or distributing food or doing anything, is already recognized by the Israeli army. And the incident took place, and I think it's the full responsibility of the Israeli government now to clarify and to provide justification, and not in the sense that justification of the killing itself, but rather demystify the circumstances that led to that catastrophic incident, given that it is not unprecedented event where many others lost their lives because of the way Israeli army has been dealing with the general population in Gaza and with the facilities that are supposed to be protected. As you have just said, the car was marked as a World Central Kitchen car. The staff who are there were already recognized by the Israeli army, and they are very well aware that they are moving while the Israeli army is aware of their very movement. The coordinates of the warehouse that they were entering and leaving in Deir al-Balah is also well known for the Israelis. The place they were unloading the goods and the food items for the people of Gaza are also well known by the Israeli army. However, the incident took place, and I think it's upon the Israeli government to explain to the world and to the different countries, including Canada, USA, Poland, and also the Poland, and I think UK, for how this happened and why this happened.
And has there been any improvement in the last week or two of the of supplies coming into Gaza, to especially food and medical supplies?
Well, the food and medical supplies are still very scarce in the Gaza Strip. The different UN figures have been voicing their concern over the fact that Israel is limiting all the supplies that are entering Gaza. Even more, Israel is being selective about what enters Gaza and what doesn't enter Gaza. The Palestinian health system at large sustained a very big blow, a very big strike, when the Al-Shifa hospital was totally destroyed. It lost 800 beds, it lost 100 dialysis machines, and it also lost one-third of the therapeutic services throughout the Gaza Strip. So the situation is dire, and it continues to get even worse. And Israel is not willing or is not able to allow more food supplies and medical supplies into the Gaza Strip. Not far away from us is Abu Yusuf al-Najjar Hospital in Rafah. The hospital is suffering because of the fact they have the access to very limited supplies, and they have been calling for the international community, they have been calling for the world, they have been calling even for Israel to allow unhindered access of the medical supplies and food supplies to help the people. They have a place for the people with dialysis that need dialysis machines, and those people need have some nutritional need, and those needs are not met. And if the situation continues the way it is, even the urgent and immediate medical needs of those people are not going to be met, which compromises their whole life.
I want to talk about this in the context of the looming famine. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians pushed to the brink of famine right now. AP is reporting Cyprus, which has played a key role in trying to establish a sea route to bring food into the territory, said ships that recently arrived were turning back with some 240 tons of undelivered aid. The World Kitchen, Chef Jose Andres's food charity, was the first to get massive amount of food into Gaza. And now we see what has happened to them. I'm wondering, Akram, are you hungry? Is your family hungry?
This is a very critical question. For you to understand, I am a Gazan. Gazan means I am living the very same circumstances that my people are living. Sometimes it's Ramadan time, and sometimes we eat one meal a day. Sometimes the meal is not as decent as you imagine for someone who's fasting for around 16 hours. This is the situation for most of the people in the Gaza. But to make a difference, people in the south of Gaza are living a little bit better life than the ones who are living in the northern Gaza. The World Central Bank organized that trip with an intention of delivering the 200 tons of food that were delivered initially in the very first pilot trip to Gaza North and Gaza City, where 700,000 Palestinians are besieged and are denied any access whatsoever, except for very limited quantities, since 1 month and a half up to this particular moment. Now, the 1,000 tons that were allowed into, the 200 tons and the 1,000 tons were not allowed into Gaza North and Gaza City, where 700,000 people are waiting for the food. The famine is not looming. The famine is already taking place. We have around 34 Palestinians, adult and young, who died from the starvation. We have many more people who are complaining about the significant loss of their wealth. We have people and children who are eager to eat anything whatsoever. People in the north ate the grass, ate whatever they can eat. They eat also the animal feed. They are sorting it out, they're cleaning it, they're grinding it, they're making bread out of it. And even when the taste and the smell is not what you expect as a human, they still have to eat it because they don't have any other option. That situation continues to be very dire, and that situation continues to deteriorate. Now, some people organized and formed some special committees for the sake of just receiving the food that is allowed, the minimum food that is allowed from the road between Rafah, Khan Yunis, and Gaza, Salah al-Din Road. And those people ended up being targeted. 70 of them were killed, and more than 500 Palestinians were killed in different incidents targeting the people around Al-Kuwait roundabout and Annabulsi roundabout when they're waiting for the food, when they're waiting for to eat. 20 different incidents of targeting that took the life of 500 Palestinians and 70 of those who are working to organize everything. The way that is now done, the way that this targeting is done indicates that Israel is willing to deprive those people from any hope and any life whatsoever.
I wanted to ask you about the Israeli Prime Minister saying he will ban the award-winning TV network Al Jazeera. The Israeli lawmakers, the Knesset, passed a bill allowing for the temporary banning of foreign broadcasters deemed to be a national security threat. Of course, Al Jazeera is the most widely viewed network in the Arab world, one of the few outlets to have reporters inside Gaza. The way the Arab world sees what's happening in Gaza, and through Al Jazeera English, the way the rest of the world sees as well. Your thoughts on what this means. I should also add, a number of Al Jazeera reporters have been killed.
Yes, the issue is that even the Knesset gave that law the name of Al Jazeera law. Al Jazeera law, which means that this is an exclusive decision that has been taken for the sake of stopping Al Jazeera from covering on the grounds of accusation that Al Jazeera is compromising and threatening the Israeli national security. Al Jazeera has reporters inside Palestine, in Gaza Strip, and inside the Israeli territory, and they have been covering the news about the situation. And I think it is the way they have been doing things that provoked the Israeli Knesset members and the Israeli government, because number one, the military ground is not, the military ground operation is not going the way they want it to go on. And it's now the 6 months that they have been facing significant obstacles achieving what they have been achieved. They have warned the Palestinians of an imminent transfer into the Egyptian side. They have been conducted some of the incidents that were described as genocidal behavior by the experts, and some of the footage that was provided by Al Jazeera was used also by South Africa when South Africa was wording and filing and providing the evidences about the ongoing situation in Gaza Strip. And that's why now Israel is defining Al Jazeera as an enemy and is trying also to chase any other news outlets that might be thinking of providing as comprehensive coverage as the one that Al Jazeera is providing, and which is so recognized by the world, by the global community, and by the people in Palestine and different areas of the Middle East. So they are trying to stop Al Jazeera, but I don't think that they have the power. And when I say the power, because now we are shifting when it comes to the media, we have the media of the citizen, we have the social media, and we have many different platforms. The performance that was conducted by Al Jazeera, I don't think is going to be stopped by any plan that Israel develops. The only issue and problem for Israel is that now when they are developing and accepting that law, they are making themselves a mockery, because there is no way to stop any voice from saying what they think is right, as long as we have all the alternative media, we have the social media, and we have the citizens' media. And I think they will continue doing what they can do from Gaza, and sometimes they would have alternative sources from inside Israel, and they will continue their message and they will continue their mission.
Well, Akram al-Satri, we want to thank you for being with us, speaking to us from Rafah in Gaza. And we have this latest news from the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. It's just reported new details about the deadly strike on Chef Andreas's World Central Kitchen aid workers. The newspaper writes, quote, "At some point when the convoy was driving along the approved route, the war room of the unit responsible for security of the route ordered the drone operators to attack one of the cars with a missile. Some of the passengers were seen leaving the car after it was hit and switching to one of the other two cars. They continued to drive and even notified the people responsible that they were attacked, but seconds later, another missile hit their car. The third car in the convoy approached, and the passengers began to transfer to it the wounded who'd survived the second strike in order to get them out of danger. But then a third missile struck them. All seven World Central Kitchen volunteers were killed in the strike." That again, Haaretz reporting the Israeli military ordered the drone strikes mistakenly, thinking a member of Hamas was part of the aid convoy. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Gaza, the death toll has now topped 32,600, including 14,000 children, with over 75,000 people wounded. At least 31 people, including 27 children, have already died of malnutrition and dehydration. For more, we go to Rafah in Gaza, where we're joined by James Elder, spokesperson for UNICEF, which stands for the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund. Welcome to Democracy Now!, James Elder. Thank you so much for joining us as you stand outside a hospital in Rafah. Talk about where you've been in Gaza and what you found.
Amy, hi there. Look, I've been south to north, north to south. If we start here in the south, in Rafah, this is a city that's normally 300,000 people, and it's now about 1.5 million. So you can imagine the congestion. I'm looking now at a field hospital. The number of times, Amy, when I'll walk around and just think, it's just place feels like a war zone. Now, of course, it is a war zone. So if I'm in a hospital, you're talking about being in a hospital, and it is absolutely heaving with people. So the corridors are now no longer corridors. They are tented off, people using blankets, whatever they can. Thousands and thousands of people trying to take refuge in hospitals. And of course, thousands and thousands of people with the wounds of war in hospitals. So here, Rafah, this is a city of children, Amy. This is where most people from Gaza have now fled, with our very real fear of an offensive here. When you go further north, to the very north, as I've been to Jabalia and Gaza City, well, firstly, you see the devastation. I'm seeing, Amy, entire cities turned to rubble, more or less, things I've never seen before. Every street, when I go with people from that city, drivers who grew up in that city and who simply don't know how to get around anymore, Amy, because they've lost those landmarks to direct them. And then you see the nutritional status, those children you spoke about. More children died overnight in the last couple of days, dehydration, malnutrition. I see those families, Amy. I see mothers in tears crouched over cots with children and babies who are paper thin. Thousands of people on the street doing that universal sign, food now. That's some sense north to south. Whatever it is, it's desperate. And exhaustion. People have done everything. They break their last piece of bread to share it. They have four or five families stay with them. But I've sat with families this morning that I can speak to. They're exhausted, and yeah, they're confused as to why they don't have the world's attention.
I wanted to get your response to the latest news, James
Elder.
I've
got no hearing, guys.
The International Court of Justice has ordered Israel to ensure unhindered aid can get into Gaza. The legally binding order was issued after a request by South Africa, which brought the genocide case to Israel in January. The court noted in its latest order, Palestinians in Gaza are no longer facing only a risk of famine, but famine is setting in. The judges also cited UN data, which finds at least 31 people, including 27 children, having already died of malnutrition and dehydration. The court is ordering Israel to submit a report within a month showing how it's implemented the order. The significance of this, as the UN warns famine is imminent in northern Gaza, and the number of children who've been affected, James.
Yes, I mean, we saw a report, Amy, almost 2 weeks ago by the most respected nutrition body in terms of crises on the planet, and it is talking about more people now being in that what we call catastrophic food insecurity than in their 20 years of reporting. If we look at the north of Gaza, where before this war, less than 1% of children under the age of five, less than 1%, suffered acute malnutrition. Now, if we look at those 0 to 2 year olds, the most vulnerable, Amy, it's 1 in 3. 1 in 3. This is the speed at which we've seen this catastrophic decline. So, yes, the United Nations, from my own executive director to the Secretary General, have been calling for months and months for unhindered, safe — it's a very difficult place to work — safe access for aid. Now, that's road access, the most efficient and effective way to get supplies, life-saving supplies, food, water, medicines to people is on the road network, not just from the south, because that can be difficult. It's 30 or 40, 30 miles. Doesn't sound like a long way. It is a long way when you've got tens of thousands of people on the street. Amy, there are crossings that are 10 minutes away from those people who are hand to mouth, from those mothers who are cradling children who are severely malnourished, 10 minutes away. So in the same way that this crisis, this nutritional crisis affecting children, civilians in Gaza, is man-made and preventable, it can be turned around. Now, if you want to be a glass half full, that's good news. This can be reversed, but we do need those decisions to be made. We need all hindrances gone, all obstructions gone. We need safety. Yeah, we know that more of my United Nations colleagues have been killed in this war than in any war since the creation of the United Nations. We've seen those horrendous videos of desperate people, desperate because they see a truck of food once a week. There is no consistency. Desperate people being killed accessing food. They're at crossings in the north. If those are opened, we can flood the Gaza Strip with aid, and this is solved within a matter of weeks. Magic pace that UNICEF has changes their lives dramatically, but we're not seeing that. Instead, UNRWA, the biggest UN agency here, the backbone of humanitarian aid on the Gaza Strip, that was sending 50%, Amy, 50% of the food to the north, they've been blocked. So we have to be very clear and very, very honest in terms of what the restrictions are. The restrictions currently are why we are seeing this level of malnutrition, particularly among children.
So why, what is Israel saying to you, to the international body, the United Nations, to you, particularly at UNICEF, why they're not letting this aid go, and particularly saying they will not work with UNRWA at all in northern Gaza?
Yes, look, obviously, you know, we function here based on our impartiality and we talk to anyone. So you're right to ask. I'm not privy to the exact conversations like anyone else. You hear the statements made that there is, you know, limitless access here. The reality on the ground says differently. In the first 3 weeks of March, one quarter of aid convoys were denied. As I say, the restrictions on UNRWA are immense. I can speak to my own experience of the complexities of even getting that food aid to the north, which is why if you come in from the north in those crossings, that's a game changer. In the same way that the world has focused a little bit on airdrops and ships. Obviously, right now the desperation is so great that those people who've been forcibly put into this position will take food aid wherever it comes from. It shouldn't be the case. When I'm in the north, you're talking about an area that was famed for strawberries, not for malnutrition, for strawberries. But we have to be clear that when a ship comes in, it has the equivalent tonnage of around 12 trucks. There are hundreds and hundreds of trucks, you know, 5 miles from where I am now. You could get hundreds and hundreds of trucks within 10 minutes if that border crossing was open in the north to those people who are cut off. That's an important thing to remember. When I was in the north, Amy, those people are cut off. You're past the last checkpoint. When we access those people, when I'm on the street, every person, the first thing they want to tell me in English or Arabic is, we need food, we need food. Now, I know this, of course, this is my work, but of course I listen to them. What was revealing is why are they saying that? They are saying that because their assumption is the world doesn't know. Because how would this be allowed to happen if the world knew?
Can you talk about the effects on children of malnutrition? If they don't die of hunger, the effects of the dehydration and malnutrition that they're experiencing now?
Yeah, look, in one sense, it's one of the saddest things you'll see, because a malnourished child, literally their body starts to feed on itself in its last desperate acts. As my executive director said when she's been in malnutrition centres around the world, remembering UNICEF, we are serving children around the world, and critical scenarios for children, particularly on nutrition, from places from Sudan to Ethiopia. And she spoke of just the silence in a malnutrition ward, because babies do not have the energy to cry. But what usually kills children with this most severe form of malnutrition is a disease, a simple thing, pneumonia, a simple childhood disease. Children with severe acute malnutrition are 10 times more likely to be killed by that. And that is something that UNICEF has been warning about here for months. Because now Rafah has become a city of children, because the water system and the sanitation system have been devastated, it's impossible to have the services here that children need. I mean, healthcare. Never before in Gaza have so many children needed healthcare. Only one-third, one in three hospitals are partially functioning. Toilets. Toilets, both in terms of dignity, but in terms of sanitation, Amy. The global standard in emergency is one toilet for 20 people. Here, we're looking at about one toilet for 800. For a shower, multiply that by four. One shower for 3,500 people. Imagine for a teenage girl, much less, yes, a pregnant woman or a child. So our great fear, which we are starting to see, is when you have severe malnutrition and you add in disease, this is the perfect storm. This is when this horror show for children becomes just as lethal on the ground as it currently is from the skies.
Now, of course, this is aside from the, I think the number has topped 14,000 of children who have died, uncounted number of them still in the rubble. If you can talk about this death toll and also compare Gaza to other conflict zones you've been in, James Elder, you've been all over the world, to say the least.
Yeah, look, for me, Amy, in a way, I'm loath to make the comparison simply because for UNICEF, for myself, of course, a child is a child wherever they are. And when you see what's happened to children, you know, from Ukraine to Afghanistan, is horrendous. And that's why my colleagues are frontline workers in all of these places. Yes, though, there is something particular here. The intensity of devastation, obviously, it's such a big child population in a compact space with, let's be clear, indiscriminate attacks. The numbers you're sharing there, it's unprecedented. And when you see in a hospital those wounds of war to children, Amy, remembering that when there is a missile or a bomb on a family home, it's not just one injury to a child, it's the broken bones, it's the burns. It's very hard to look, but we must keep looking. The burns on a child, and it's the shrapnel. These are the images that I turn every time I turn around in a hospital, and I don't think I've seen that consistency. You have these rare moments, Amy, of clutching onto some hope. And once was a moment in a hospital, a little boy, Muhammad. Now, he had bad burns, but as I walked into Muhammad, he made this little effort it hurt him to put two little thumbs up, an unsolicited movement. And I just thought, wow, what a character. And then the adult with him explained that Muhammad was also the best student in his school, showed me photographs of this beautiful little boy receiving awards. And I thought, this little guy's going to be okay, and you hold on to these moments. Then that adult explained to me that when the missile hit Muhammad's home, it killed everyone. And because families are bunkering down, I mean everyone, mother, father, siblings, grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins. Muhammad didn't know this yet, but Muhammad is now the last surviving member of his entire family. These horror stories, Amy, are being normalized here. I didn't think I'd ever hear such a thing in Gaza. I'm hearing it time and again. So yes, and these wounds of war, I should add, you know, in the last 2 days, I made a point to go to hospitals since the ceasefire decision, which was a cause of great hope here, great hope. Well, that hope has been well and truly drowned out right now by bombs. And I saw many children who doctors did not think would still be alive today based on the bombings that have occurred since Monday's decision.
You're standing, James Elder, in Rafah. if you can talk about what's happening right now in Rafah. You have Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu saying it absolutely an invasion, ground invasion, will happen. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. You have talked about a possible ground invasion in Rafah. What would this mean?
The horrors in Gaza do start to outstrip our ability to describe them, and it would be a catastrophe. But of course, that word has been rightly used many times. But this is a city of children. As I say, this city, Rafah, now has twice the population density of New York City. But I don't know what you can see, okay? But that's as tall as they get. This is ground level, and most people are in tents. They're in street corners, they're on beaches, they're in what was agriculture. They're ground level, 600,000 children here. And what they've endured, I mean, we're in uncharted territory when it comes to the mental health of these children, Amy. Night after night, even for me, and I get to leave this place. For me, I lie in bed and you hear the bombardments that wake you and your building shakes and you lie there feeling like lying in a coffin. Like, what are the chances of waking tomorrow morning? Children here go through that with their families every night. Every night with a mother and child, there's no lullaby you sing to a child to drown that out. And so for those people here, not only are they just holding on, their coping mechanisms at a wit's end, they have nowhere to go. We have to understand that it's not, you know, the social services are devastated. So the Khan Yunis, the city next door, as I say, I've never seen that level of annihilation. Gaza City, further north, the same. There's talk of an area near here, Almawasi, it's a beach. You know, you'd be doubling the population density again. So It's a terrifying thought, Amy. I didn't imagine it would come to this, but yes, as you rightly say, the conversation is very commonplace now. I just wish people could see the density of people here, could see the exhaustion, could listen to a doctor as I speak to a hospital as he's treating a child with massive head wounds, and the doctor's in tears saying, what did this child do? Well, we will see that on a scale I don't think any of us, certainly not me, can imagine.
Finally, what would an immediate ceasefire mean for the children of Gaza, for the whole population there?
No, I'm glad you end like that, because that gives me a chill in my... Everyone asks still, do we have hope? Is there hope? And most people hold on to this idea, Amy, of like, as a mother said, I've lost two children. I've lost my home. I've lost my ability to earn income. I've lost my ability to feed my remaining child. All I have is hope. Now, a ceasefire is a game changer. Ceasefire. Firstly, let's get the hostages home. There are children somewhere after 5.5 months. End the torment for they and their families. A ceasefire enables us finally to flood the Gaza Strip with aid and bring this nutritional crisis, imminent famine. Make no doubt about it, imminent famine. And a ceasefire, Amy, means that those families that I spoke of, who tonight again will endure what I mentioned there, they will go to bed if there's a ceasefire, a mother and her child, and they will know for the first time in months that they will wake up tomorrow.
James Elder, UNICEF spokesperson. UNICEF stands for the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund, joining us today from Rafah in the Gaza Strip. Thank you so much, and be safe. Israeli forces withdrew from Gaza's largest hospital, Al-Shifa, today, after a two-week raid that's left most of the medical complex in ruins, with dead bodies on the ground in a wasteland of charred and destroyed buildings. The government media office in Gaza said over 400 Palestinians were killed and over 1,000 homes in the area of Al-Shifa destroyed. Army bulldozers also plowed over a makeshift cemetery in the hospital courtyard. The World Health Organization said at least 21 patients died since the raid began March 18th. Built in 1946, Shifa was once the flagship medical facility in Gaza. Since October, Gaza's health sector has been completely decimated. Only two hospitals are minimally functional and 10 partially functional, according to the United Nations. The rest have shut down completely after being shelled, besieged and raided by Israeli troops or running out of fuel and medicine. On Sunday, an Israeli airstrike hit a tent encampment outside of Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah. The attack killed two Palestinians and injured seven journalists. The death toll in Gaza is nearly 33,000, including 14,000 children. Many thousands of others are missing under the rubble and presumed dead. The number of wounded has topped 75,000. For more, we're joined by Dr. Hassan Abousseta, a British-Palestinian reconstructive surgeon. He worked in Gaza for over a month as a volunteer with Doctors Without Borders, treating patients at both Al-Shifa and Al-Ahli Baptist Hospitals. He's joining us from London. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. So you have heard the news, Dr. Abousseta. Al-Shifa destroyed, the largest medical complex in the Gaza Strip. Can you talk about its significance and then talk about your experiences when you were in Gaza?
First of all, if you'll allow me, Amy, I'd like to start by paying tribute to my friend and colleague, Dr. Ahmed Al-Maqadna, a young, brilliant plastic surgeon with whom I had worked at Shifa during this war and at Al-Ahli Hospital. And I'd worked with him before, during the 21 war and during the marches of return. His body, alongside that of his mother, were found today when the Israeli troops withdrew, and they had been executed by the Israeli army while trying to escape Shifa. Dr. Ahmed was a brilliant and dedicated young surgeon. who had won the Humanitarian Fellowship of the Royal College of Surgeons of England. And it's critical that we remember their names and we remember their stories. And today I want to send my love to his wife and to his children, both under the age of 5, who are now left without a husband and a father, along with so many of my colleagues who we've lost. This is the second plastic surgeon who I had worked with at Shifa, who has been killed by the Israeli, and over 345 doctors and nurses and paramedics who've been killed by the Israelis, intentionally targeted. Now, with regards to Shifa, Shifa was 30% of the capacity of the health system in Gaza. And so the destruction of Shifa, the wanton destruction of Shifa, is a critical component of Israel's plan to genocidally make sure that Gaza becomes an uninhabitable place even after a ceasefire happened. By destroying Shifa and making sure that it is irreparable, the Israelis are trying to make sure that for years to come, Gaza does not have a functioning health system. Shifa now needs to be completely demolished and a new building and a new hospital built, which means you're looking at 3 to 5 years once the building starts. This is part of the genocidal machine. But for me, as someone who has, you know, I reached Shifa Hospital on the 10th of October, on the morning of the Tuesday, and was in Shifa on and off throughout my whole 43 days in Gaza. It is not just the Israeli soldiers and the Israeli leaders, the genocidal tip of the iceberg that I blame. I blame the Western journalists who perpetuated the narrative that militarized the hospital as a justifiable and an acceptable target to the Israelis. These genocide enablers, these Western journalists, from the very beginning, peddled these stories that the Israelis were feeding them about Shifa being on top of this massive complex of command and control center. And their job was to enable the genocide to take place. And the genocide can only take place if the health system is destroyed. And so their hand, blood of my friend, blood of Ahmed Maqadmi, is on the hands of the CNN journalists and the BBC journalists and the ITV journalists, who from the very beginning were peddling this narrative.
I'm looking at a comment right now from Raed Al-Nim, a representative for the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, who said many departments at Al-Shifa Hospital were set on fire. Many bodies are lying around the ground. Al-Nim told Al Jazeera, the situation is dire. The medical staff, some of them killed, others tortured, others detained. Above all, they've been besieged for 2 weeks without any medical supplies or even food or water. Shifa itself means healing. It's a house of healing. Also, 1,000 houses in the area were also destroyed as the Israeli military destroyed the hospital. Dr. Ghassan Abu Sita, as you work there, can you talk about, especially since you are a reconstructive surgeon, the child amputees and what they face in there and the other hospitals you worked in?
So from the very beginning, it was obvious that half of the wounded were children. And on a daily basis, my operating list would be between 8 and 12 surgeries. And half of them were children. And the sheer ferocity of the bombing, the fact that the Israelis were targeting people's homes, meant that a lot of these children, either their limbs were blown right off at the explosion or were crushed beyond repair as a result of the debris and the collapsing buildings that they were taken from underneath. as the war progressed, as the health system became so overwhelmed, previously reconstructable limb became unreconstructable and required amputation to save the patient's lives from gangrene and infection. And so what we have is a process by which these children, and my estimate is that they are now probably around 4,000 to 5,000. These children are now left with disability that will change the course of their life. We know from the medical literature that each child with a lower limb prosthetic will need a new prosthetic every 6 months because their body outgrows the length of the prosthesis, and will need between 8 and 12 surgery by the time they're of adult age, because the bone grows faster than the soft tissues, or the nerves attach themselves to the skin and they can't wear the prosthesis. And so this is a lifelong trajectory of surgery and of disability and of mental health scarring as a result of the deformity. To take into account, in addition to this, that a lot of these children are orphaned. You know, there are 17,000 children in Gaza who've lost their parents, and many of these are wounded children. And so to go through all of this with no family to look after you is just, the legacy will be the legacy of this war. And this is a war from the very beginning. This was a war Israel declared on Palestinian children. You know, Israel wanted to wipe out Palestinian children because Palestinian children represent the Palestinian tomorrow that is incompatible with the Zionist settler colonial project. Zionists cannot envisage a Palestinian tomorrow, and we're targeting Palestinian children.
I wanted to quote from The New Yorker, that quotes you extensively, Doctor, as you talk about this is the biggest cohort of pediatric amputees in history. Eliza Griswold writes, to mark the gravity of these procedures and to mourn, Abu Setha and other medical staff place the severed limbs of children in small cardboard boxes. They labeled the boxes with masking tape on which they wrote a name and a body part and buried them. Talk more about what you did.
There was one night when I was in Ahli Hospital, when the Israelis had targeted a mosque which had been used by the internally displaced, where by 5 o'clock that morning, I had performed amputations on 6 children. And such is the aim to dehumanize these children, the aim of the settler colonialist genocidal war, to dehumanize these children, that my colleagues and I wanted to maintain their dignity and wanted to not just bear witness, but to hold on to anything that makes us and them human in the face of this dehumanizing war machine. And so we insisted that whenever there was a limb that was amputated, that it gets the right burial, and that this child's name is on that amputated limb, and that we maintain the dignity of our patient to the extent that we can.
Doctor, the Washington Post is reporting the Biden administration just authorized the transfer of billions of dollars in bombs and fighter jets to Israel. The arms package, including more than 1,800 MK-84 2,000-pound bombs, which can be used to level entire city blocks. U.S. also sending 500 MK-82 500-pound bombs and 25 F-35 fighter jets. I'm wondering if you can comment on this, especially in light of recently being elected rector of the University of Glasgow, your alma mater. It was a position once held by Winnie Mandela. You won by a wide majority running on a pro-Palestinian solidarity platform and urging divestment from the arms trade. Can you talk about this?
So one of the things you do realize when you leave this death world in Gaza and you come out to the outside world is that you come to realize that Israel is just the tip of the genocidal iceberg. But the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Italy, all of these NATO countries represent the remainder of the genocidal project. Israel, and these countries are not just supporting Israel. They are supporting Israel's genocidal project. Because as the Colombian president said, they want to send the message to any other troublesome native who consider changing the rules of the global game by rebelling. And so when we talk about the genocide, we should not just talk about the Israelis as the perpetrators of the genocide. We should talk about the axis of genocide, these countries, these governments that are perpetuating this genocide. And we know just not just this article. There's also been another article showing how much intelligence information has been passed on to the Israelis that ensured the Israelis are able to carry out these massacres. And so when we talk about the genocide, it's an American, British, French, European genocide against the Palestinian people, not of which Israel is the spearhead, but not just the sole perpetrator.
Finally, there were perhaps as many as 200,000 people protesting in London alone this weekend. That's where you're speaking from, Dr. Hassan Abou-Zeita. Talk about the significance of this, and if this is making a difference, wasn't there also a letter from something like 150 British MPs who wrote a letter demanding stopping the arming of Israel?
Since the International Court of Justice produced its interim ruling that this is plausibly a genocidal war, and I think there's no one that has any doubt about this, the British government is now legally complicit in the act of genocide. The universities that hold shares in BAE Systems, the arms manufacturers that has continued to supply weapons to Israel, are also complicit. And this is one of the things that we ran on as part of the campaign for rector of Glasgow University. If you own shares in an arms company that has sent parts or complete weapons to the Israelis in this genocidal war, you are complicit under international law in genocide. All of this highlights the fact that this is a genocidal project that extends from Tel Aviv to London, to Washington, to Paris, to Rome, to all of these countries. These are genocidal partners, complicit in an attempt to wipe out the Palestinian people. The 200,000, hundreds of thousands of people who are coming out every weekend, be it in Europe or North America, are basically saying not in our name. They will not be complicit in the acts of genocide that their governments are perpetrating. These people want to absolve themselves from what their governments are doing by refusing to be part of a genocidal war in the 21st century.
I want to end with Dr. Feroz Sidwa, a trauma surgeon who's currently volunteering at European Hospital in Khan Yunis in Gaza right now. We've been trying to reach him nonstop for the show today, but in case we couldn't, which we can't, he can almost never do live communication. It just doesn't work. He sent us this voice message. He's working with the Palestinian American Medical Association in collaboration with the World Health Organization. On Sunday, Dr. Sidwa sent this update as he walked from his living quarters to the European hospital.
The hospital itself is basically a displaced persons camp. I just walked out of my—I live in a little building called the Midan, I think it's square. It's kind of an outlying area of the hospital. And, just walking into the hospital, it's only about a five-minute walk. I mean, it's just squalor everywhere. everywhere. The kids running around without shoes, kids running around with sores, people actually wheeling their family members around in hospital beds sometimes. A bunch of cars that can't move anywhere because there's no gasoline. They're using them as beds and shelters sometimes. But, you know, you can see there's no privacy, no dignity for any of these people, but they somehow maintain their humanity. It's pretty impressive to see, actually. I'm walking by the four latrines that people share here. I'm told there's 20,000 people on this on the hospital grounds, and they share four latrines. It's ridiculous. You can imagine the smell. And it's literally right in front of the hospital main entrance, which is also a giant tent city. But yeah, no, you know, the way these people attempt to maintain some of their own dignity and humanity, you know, they're maintaining their custom of Ramadan, they're still staying in family units despite the fact that they have been displaced multiple times each. A lot of them, this is their, you know, leaving aside the, you know, 1948 and 1967 displacements, as some of them have been displaced three or four times just from this war. Half of the medical students, their families are dead. They were displaced. Hello. Half of them were displaced from, the kids love to say hello to anybody that they can figure out as a foreigner. And, you know, half the medical students, their families, their family members have died. They, and still, you know, they're not even in medical school down here, but they go, they come down here, they, and they just came to Gaza European Hospital to volunteer. And they actually run the emergency room for the most part right now.
That was Dr. Fedoz Sidwa at European Hospital Khan Yunis Sunday. Final words to Dr. Hassan Abu Sata, who is recently out of Gaza, British-Palestinian reconstructive surgeon. Your final thoughts.
You know, today, as we grieve for our friend, one tries to maintain a level of hope. And so we end with the words of the immortal Bobby Sands. We will defeat them with the laughter of our children.
That's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity radio show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
On Saturday, April 6th, the Milton Park Food Bank is hosting a bazaar with a variety of vendors selling vintage clothing, shoes, accessories, decor, and much more. They will also be selling a delicious, hearty, homemade lunch for $5. The food bank distributes food and serves hot meals to neighbors in need. The Milton Park Bazaar will be held at 3594 Jean Mals in the basement of St. John's Lutheran Church from 12 to 3 p.m. on Saturday, April 6th. That's this Saturday on the corner of Jean Mals and Prince Arthur. Hope to see you there. Help us bring food to the table. For more info, contact mpfoodbank@gmail.com.
Hello everyone, this is KP. Welcome to Venus Radio. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. Thank you for tuning in today. We are a feminist music show, and today I'm just going to be playing